Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Johnson, and I'm here today with Andrew McEvitt, Assistant Professor of History at Louisiana Tech University, to talk about his new book, Consuming Japan, Popular Culture, and the Globalizing of 1980s America. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Matt, thank you so much for having me.
So I'd like to start just, Andrew, what I loved about this book was it's a book about globalization without this kind of top-down economic policy history. So what made you want to write a book about Americans' encounter with Japanese goods rather than, you know, a trade policy history between the United States and Japan?
Well, it's a good question. You know, this project started about a dozen years ago now. When I first started writing a paper in a graduate level seminar on Japanese animation fans in the United States in the 1970s and the 1980s, I went to graduate school. I started graduate school in 2002, I guess, and I was really interested in the Cold War, and I was thinking that maybe I would do something related to like nuclear policy or something like that when I went to study with a traditional diplomatic historian in graduate school. I was interested in like early nuclear culture and stuff like that, the anti-nuclear protest movement. And early in grad school, I'd happened to borrow a DVD from my brother, who's 7 years younger than me, which in like pop culture terms is like a whole generation. And he was a Pokemon kid. I don't know if you were a Pokemon kid, Matt. I wasn't a Pokemon kid. Because for me, I was just a little too old for it. But he was a Pokemon kid. He's really into Japanese pop culture. And I had borrowed and watched this film called Akira, which is a 1988 cult classic directed by Otomo Katsuhiro. The film opens with this bird's eye view of Tokyo, and the date in 1988 flashes on the screen, and then suddenly the whole city is annihilated by a nuclear detonation, and then the narrative jumps ahead in like 30 years in the future, and it's about these kids who get these like godlike powers as a result of government experimentation and these nuclear sciences and so forth. It's very anime-like setup. But as someone interested in the history of like the Cold War at that particular moment, I couldn't help but think there's got to be something here. And as a historian, I couldn't help but think there must be a history here of how this cultural text, this like cult classic film from Japan in 1988 comes to the United States during a decade in which global nuclear anxieties were on high alert, especially earlier in the decade with the bellicose rhetoric of the first Reagan administration. And so as I started to ask questions about that history, and I found that the early American fans of Japanese animation, otherwise known as anime, and I talked to many of them. I started collecting many of their stories, and I collected their self-produced materials related to anime fandom in the United States during the 1970s and the 1980s. And so the book project really began with my interest in their cultural activities. And what became obvious very quickly was that these fans spread throughout the United States, people who went to great lengths to get anime on like underground copies of VHS tapes. They weren't doing this because of Cold War anxieties or anything really related to the Cold War, but instead they were engaging in these processes that we'd come to associate with contemporary globalization. They're interested in cultural difference. They're interested in anime because it's so different than the American pop culture that thrived all around them. And these kind of new media tools of the late 20th century, like VCRs and stuff like this, it enabled them to build these local and national and even transnational communities based on the pursuit of difference and cultural difference in that sense. So thinking about these kind of big narratives of the post-war United States, the Cold War, the Reagan Revolution, and thinking about how we talk about globalization in the late 20th century, these anime fans didn't really seem to fit in neatly anywhere. So I became interested in how anime fandom was embedded in this bigger story of the global spread of Japanese culture and commerce, especially beginning in the 1970s. And so my interest in globalization in Japan took off from there.
Oh, let's talk about just how difficult it is to tell a story like this, right? If you were to do a traditional trade policy, you'd probably go to presidential libraries or perhaps the National Archives. How do you start researching a book about Americans' experience consuming Japanese goods?
Well, it did begin with that kind of anime experience, which in itself is, you know, I thought about the time that I was kind of creating my own archive. What I did in that instance was, I did interviews, what we'd call interviews, and I talked to people from that era who were fans from that era. But the most valuable thing I did was created a kind of questionnaire. It was very open-ended, and it allowed the anime fans that I had made contact with, people who were fans in the 70s and 80s, basically to write their story. And I ended up with, I don't remember how many people exactly I had gotten responses from, maybe 4 or 5 dozen. But when I added all of that up, that was many hundreds of pages of kind of personal testimonies about their own early experiences with anime and Japanese pop culture. So there was no anime fan archive at that particular moment. Today, there sort of is. I mean, there's a couple things. There's the Fred Patton archive out at California Riverside, Fred Patton was sort of the dean of American anime fans and science fiction fans for a long time. And when he passed away, he donated all of his materials there. So a lot of the stuff that I collected myself over the years by making contact with fans, even digging stuff up off of the internet, wherever you could find it, most of that couldn't be found in an archive. So you're right in that. Especially foreign policy historians. So that's my kind of lineage in the discipline. I come from the background of American foreign policy historians or foreign relations historians, or used to be called diplomatic historians. And today they're sort of international and they do transnational and these kinds of things. They tend to be very focused on archives. The traditional archive, going to the National Archives and going to presidential libraries, is the way they've often told stories about how the United States has engaged with the world. I even remember the very first conversation I had with my advisor about this project when I said, I'm looking at these people in the late 70s and they're interested in Japanese stuff. And he said, oh, that's great. Well, you can go to the Carter the library. And I'm thinking like, that's not the people I'm talking about. This is very much a kind of grassroots from the bottom up sort of foreign relations. And so over the course of working on this project, I thought about the many very different ways that Americans can engage with the world around them. Of course, there are the very important ways in which the United States engages with the world in state-to-state relations and engages with the world even transnational relations of corporations and these other big actors. But even on the ground in consuming foreign produced things and consuming things from other countries, that is a kind of foreign relations. And how can we write those kinds of histories? And it is a challenge for each chapter in the book, I think, is organized around a different set of sources, a different kind of archive in that sense. The chapter on VCRs is all I dug through trade journals and industry journals to look at the ways in which people were talking about VCRs when they first arrived and their alleged Japanese-ness. Sushi, you dig into that by looking at food magazines and food writers and the things they're writing in the 60s and 70s, menus and cookbooks and so forth. So you just have to sort of get creative about what it means to look at an archive, and not, especially when in a subdiscipline that's often centered around archives themselves, think very differently about what an archival source can be.
Right. So you decide to start this book in 1975. Why start this in 1975?
Increasingly, I think historians are coming to see the 1970s as a real kind of fulcrum in post-war American history. I think a couple of decades ago, we had fallen under the spell of Reagan-era hagiography, and this really accelerated after his death in 2004, 2005. This idea that 1980 represented some like true break in post-war American politics and society and culture. I mean, there's a lot of newer work, and I think your work falls into this category as well. And And I'm thinking of, you know, books by people like Jefferson Cowie and Meg Jacobs and Judith Stein and Daniel Rogers, among others, that has come to see many of the political and economic and social changes we once associated with the Reagan era, instead finding them in the 1970s. And so I say in the book, rather than thinking about the 1980s as an era that created Reagan, historians are, I think, more interested now in seeing the 1970s as an era that created Reagan, with Reagan being this kind of stand-in for the shift toward, you know, conservative politics and neoliberal economics, the emergence of the culture wars. He's a shorthand for many of these different changes. So at least at the level of like historiography in the post-war United States, that's the conversation I wanted to contribute to. Now, there's more specific reasons to start in the mid-1970s related to the United States' relationship with Japan. So it's a real moment of flux in this relationship. The various Nixon shocks, as they become known, in the early 1970s, these mark a turning point in the relationship that since the U.S. occupation of Japan, it had been defined by a security alliance in which the United States has guaranteed Japan's defense against Cold War rivals, at least since the treaty revision in 1960, and then an economic relationship in which the United States promotes Japan's very rapid recovery and its growing prosperity, even doing so at the detriment of like U.S. industries, with the aim of securing Japan internally against communist threats, but also making Japan an exemplar of like what a liberal capitalist society could be in the Cold War world. And by the early 1970s, at least, that had worked better than anyone had expected. So much so that Japan becomes the world's largest or second largest economy by 1972 or so, depending on how you measure these things. By the Nixon administration, we get an increasing number of critics of U.S. policy toward Japan. These are critics who are saying that the Japanese have had a free ride for too long, and importantly, they don't give up enough in return, that their industries compete unfairly against U.S. industries. They're destroying those industries, all while benefiting from U.S. military protection and American economic generosity. So we see these criticisms in a range of industries, most notably automobiles by the 70s and the 80s, but you also see it in steel and televisions. And the biggest issue in the 1960s, which, you know, when you say like, this is the biggest, most controversial issue in the 1960s for U.S.-Japan relations, everyone's like eyes roll into the back of their head, but it was textiles. The Nixon administration was just adamant that Japan was dumping cheap textiles into the U.S. market and trying to crush the U.S. textile industry. There's a series of years-long complex negotiations over this stuff. So at the presidential level, Nixon sees these kinds of debates as evidence that Japan had matured, that it was no longer this dependent client state, but a wealthy world power that it could survive on its own. And so he announces a number of policy changes that shock Japan in 1971, 72. This includes the end of the gold standard. This forces an immediate increase in the value of the yen. There's a 10% surcharge on certain categories of exports. And then couple that with Nixon's announcement that he's going to go to China, which came as like a complete surprise to the Japanese. And you have in the early 1970s this clear turning point in the relationship between what is the world's two biggest capitalist powers. The last thing worth mentioning in that very quickly in that regard is the oil crises of the 1970s. The sudden imposition of limits and American consumers' needs to adapt to those limits to find, or at least to them finding the smaller and more efficient Japan-produced vehicles increasingly more competitive across the decade. And of course, that's going to threaten the flagship U.S. industry, the automobile industry.
And you spent a lot of time early in the book, you know, talking about Americans' initial reaction to all of these Japanese goods that start to flow into the United States. And one of the terms you use is the Japan panic, right? And so I was wondering if you would tell listeners, you know, what that actually looks like. And does that go away at some point? And if it does, when does that panic start to go away?
Yeah, so it's funny. I mean, what you know and what you remember about the Japan panic seems very much contingent on how old you are. So people born after, say, like 1985, maybe, this all just sounds like really weird and alien and totally unfamiliar. So the Japan Panic is this, it's this brief, intense, but ultimately fleeting moment when many people in the United States were convinced that the greatest challenge the United States faced in the world wasn't from the Soviet Union or international terrorism or even a rising China, but from Japan. Japan's remarkable, its miracle recovery in the 1950s, and then its skyrocketing growth in the 60s and 70s meant that by the 1980s, it's a global economic superpower. Its companies and their representatives, the iconic Japanese salaryman, they're stretching across the globe selling Toyotas and Toshibas and cars and cameras and so many of these other high-end manufactured products that make Japan the world's second largest economy. And by the late 1980s, especially, Japanese corporations are flush with cash and they start buying up lots of property in the United States. Some of it is iconically American. There's like Rockefeller Center in New York, Pebble Beach Golf Club, even Columbia Records. So the record label that puts out Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA, it's bought by Japan in the late 1980s, well, bought by Sony. So Japan's economic power and its buying sprees that come as a result, this provokes all kinds of anxieties among white Americans in particular. And they have ways of making sense of that, of course, ways that they borrow from the past. Some of them reach as far back to the mid-19th century to these yellow peril scripts about an invasion of a faceless, indistinguishable and East Asians with their impenetrable alien culture and so forth.
You know, when you move from the kind of Japan panic that you kind of set up the book with, you start moving into how Americans actually kind of experience Japanese companies. And you move into, you know, a location that I would never have thought I would ever hear when I'm talking about globalization, which is Marysville, Ohio. Right? It's like, how does Marysville, Ohio become such an important part of this book and important to a story about globalization?
Right. So Marysville, Ohio, it's a small town about 30 miles northwest of Columbus. So central Ohio today, it's about 20,000 people, but early 1980s, it was maybe about 7,000 people. So it's here in rural central Ohio that Honda builds the first Japanese owned auto production facility in the United States. It opens in 1982. Honda had already been making motorcycles in Marysville since 1979, but the auto plant in 1982 is a much more significant capital investment. For years at this point, 1982, Japanese auto companies had been planning manufacturing facilities in the United States, and Honda is the first to take a leap to it. Nissan would do it a year later outside of Nashville in a town called Smyrna, Tennessee. Some analysts, you know, thinking about Honda, some analysts would say it's because Honda is smaller and leaner than Toyota and Nissan, so it can be more nimble when it comes to leaping to these sorts of risks and so forth. Honda says it's committed to building cars where it sells them and employing people in the places where they sell those cars. But they can also read the handwriting on the wall. Increasingly throughout the 1970s, Japan is facing criticism in the United States for selling so much stuff in the U.S. market, but buying very little in return. So we have these ballooning trade deficits between the United States and Japan, which by the middle of the 1980s reach into the tens of millions and hundreds of billions of dollars. So the ballooning trade deficit is on the minds of Japanese executives throughout the 1970s. And manufacturing stuff in the United States is one way to work around it. In fact, Sony started doing this years before, even in 1972. They start making televisions in San Diego. They open up a VHS cassette manufacturing plant in Alabama in like 1979. Honda chooses Ohio after Ohio's governor recruits them quite aggressively. This is James Rhodes. He's a longtime governor of Ohio, the same governor who sent out the National Guard in 1970 to Kent State. He's still governor in the late 1970s. And he recruits Honda quite aggressively. He offers this sort of greenfield space outside of Marysville, which is in Union County. without anyone in Marysville or Union County knowing he's doing that. So the governor's assistant rolls into like a Union County commissioner's meeting one day in 1977 and just says, like, Honda's coming. Here's the things we promised them, and we expect all of you to make it happen. And they had promised them a lot of stuff. They promised them tax abatements and sewer lines and road expansions, all of these sorts of things that become commonplace later on for bringing foreign manufacturers into these local spaces. The governor of Ohio promises much of that. There's pushback in the local community, but the promise of jobs is just too powerful. Marysville, at this moment, end of 1970s, it's a place that's been hit really hard by the downturn of the decade. It's got high unemployment, the businesses have closed, people are desperate for work, and that's what Honda is going to bring. Sort of spoiler alert, but within a decade of the opening of the plant, by like 1992, Union County's unemployment rate, which had been in the high teens, it's virtually vanished. It's down to like 3%. The county goes from either the poorest or one of the three poorest in the state to the wealthiest in the state, at least in terms of per capita. And the Honda plant there is the largest facility of its kind in the United States, the most productive facility of its kind in the United States. And this is the first Japanese transplant, as they're known, that transforms this town and more broadly the region across central Ohio. By 1989, they've opened a second assembly plant just a few miles up the road from the first. They've also built an engine plant about an hour away in the town of Anna to the west. By one state accounting, at the 25th anniversary, Honda was responsible for something like 60,000 jobs in Ohio, either directly or indirectly. And in many ways, it's a real economic success story, and it signals a major turn in the U.S. auto industry, because today we've got more than two dozen transplants in the United States, most of them located in the South. The Marysville plant is unique in that regard, and being in Ohio. Of course, a major transformation like this doesn't come without its detractors, and the biggest detractor is going to be the United Auto Workers, the UAW, the big, powerful union that, when the plant opened up in 1982, the UAW represents every single worker in every auto production facility in the United States. And they expect here, too, that they're going to represent all of Honda's workers as well. So the UAW goes about the task of organizing those workers, first when the motorcycle plant opens, but then more aggressively when the auto plant opens, and that leads to some conflicts down the road.
Yeah, those middle chapters are such a great counter story to the kind of the typical story that I think of in the 1970s as, you know, a bunch of workers really, really mad about globalization because they're losing their jobs, right? Anyone interested in the 1970s needs to read these middle chapters here because they're really well written. So why don't we move on to the final chapters of this book, where you're moving kind of from American workers' experience with a Japanese company to Americans' experience actually consuming stuff from Japan. And so you focus on the VCR, sushi, and anime, three just very different products. And so why, when you were writing this book, why do you settle on those three products?
It's a good question. Simply because I wanted products or Japanese goods that sort of stood out as iconically Japanese. But at the same time, there's some sort of debate about this, right? So there's an anthropologist who writes about this about a decade or so ago, maybe a little more, a decade and a half ago. His name's Koichi Owabuchi. In a book on the globalization of Japanese pop culture. And his rather provocative thesis is that Japan is good at producing goods that lack a cultural odor. That's the phrase he uses, a cultural odor. In other words, they don't have a scent that is detectably Japanese. There's all these sort of weird visceral ideas I get when we think about smelling nationality or something like that.
Yeah, I love that term. When I read that in the book, I circled it. That's such a great term.
I know, cultural odor, but I also think it's a very fraught term.
Absolutely.
But he's thinking of things like cars, and he has the three C's. I forget what he calls them. It's I think cars might be one of them, consumer electronics, cartoons, things like that. So he's thinking of cars and consumer electronics like the VCR and the Walkman. He's thinking of video games like Nintendo's Super Mario Brothers, even Japan's animation. He says it's anime because anime characters are often drawn in what Japanese creators call a mukokuseki style, which translates kind of as like one without a nationality, someone without a nationality. So he says all of this means that Japanese pop culture crosses borders easily because it doesn't contain a Japanese scent, which is sort of crucial in the post-war era, if you think about it, because, you know, Japan's, the American market is really important for Japan, but more important for Japan is the East Asian market. And Japan does not have a good reputation for good reasons in post-war East Asia. So the ability of its goods to cross borders without bringing a Japanese quote-unquote cultural odor with it is really important. And, you know, contrast that with American pop culture in the post-war era, whether it's like American films or fashion or fast food. Much of it explicitly or implicitly carries with it these ideas we identify as American, whether, you know, the Marlboro Man and the iconography of the American West, or the hip cool of like Levi's jeans, or the even like McDonald's fast food connotes this kind of, you know, modern, fast, convenient American identity. So I agree with Iwabuchi to an extent that consuming Japanese things was easy to do in an era of sort of conflict between the United States and Japan, or at least animosity, because, you know, buying a Walkman didn't bring to mind these kind of traditional images of Japan. So I wanted several goods that kind of walked the span between something that seemed that very obviously didn't seem to have any cultural odor, something like the VCR, and some other things that carried with it notions of Japaneseness, something like sushi or something like anime.
Yeah, and when you get into the sushi and anime, you start talking about hybridity a lot, right? Kind of hybrid products. And so I was wondering if you could explain to the listeners, you know, what you mean by that term hybrid that makes it a bit different than the VCR.
Right. Yeah. There's a very different kind of consuming experience when you choose to eat sushi, or you're even, I would say, and I think I would disagree with Iwabuchi on this, that when you choose to watch anime, because there are millions, tens of millions of Americans who buy a Toyota or a Honda car who aren't thinking about the Japanese-ness of that product when they do that, or they're, you know, buying a VCR or something like that. It's a very different experience, or you're making a very different consuming choice when you choose to eat sushi or watch anime. You know, oftentimes consumers did this because they're seeking some kind of authentic Japanese experience. And this is what I write about in the sushi chapter in particular. The sushi Americans ate in the 1970s was almost always a hybridized sort, adjusted slightly or even to a great deal by usually Japanese chefs making food for Americans, thinking that they're changing the food slightly to appeal to American palates. The classic example of this is if you think about a sushi roll, the kind of sushi roll you'd get in a Japanese restaurant in the United States, the rice will be typically on the outside of the roll, whereas the traditional, more traditional Japanese preparation is to have the rice on the inside of the roll and the nori, the black seaweed paper, on the outside of the roll. The first chef who put the rice on the outside said, "Americans aren't going to eat paper, so I'm going to put the paper on the inside to hide the paper from the Americans." And so it's a hybridized sort of experience. It makes it a kind of hybridized experience in that sense. But in the 1970s, food writers and presumably many foodies of the era, they go to sushi restaurants in search of what they believe to be these authentic experiences. So food writers would note that a restaurant had like you got a check plus if you had like a woman dressed like a geisha, or you had like paper lanterns decorating the place, if the food was presented in what you considered these sort of stereotypical, like clean, simple fresh Japanese style presentations. And all of this would factor into their assessment of the authenticity of the food. And of course, its quality too. You know, as a historian, I'm less interested in whether or not these things were truly authentic, but instead more in this notion of authenticity and why is it so important to people? And initially, that authenticity is important. It defines sort of the quality and the experience. But later, by the turn of the century, American consumers come to enjoy the seemingly off-the-wall hybridity of it all, like sushi made with cream cheese and avocados and fried chicken and everything else that would have seemed like heresy to foodies looking for that authentic experience a decade earlier. And that's undoubtedly a product of globalization, the kind of mixing of cultural practices and tastes that may offend people with notions of some sort of sacred authenticity. But I think it's all for the better. And the same thing goes for anime, for early anime fans. You know, the fans in the local and even later the national fan clubs by the 1980s, the authenticity, the allegedly pure Japanese-ness of the anime that they watched, that was the thing that they prized most. But I think today that defines the kind of coolness of anime far less so than for young people in the United States today than its kind of then it's general difference and in many ways it's kind of transgressiveness, which is in part what the community has always been about.
Yeah, I mean, when I read those last couple of chapters, and this might be just because I'm a very cynical person, which I wish I wasn't, but you know, I read those last two chapters, and you know, I come to the conclusion that you know Americans just can only handle a small amount of cultural difference in their products. Am I just being way too cynical when I read those chapters?
Yeah, I think you're being a little. I think you're being a little too cynical. You know, I'm suspicious of this idea that there can be an authentic, like foreign cultural experience in this case. And like that I'm suspicious of this idea that there's like an authentic Japanese-ness for Americans to consume. Cause it's premised on these older 19th century ideas about like national cultures that they have some essential characteristics that can define them. Like the Americans are industrious and the Germans are disciplined and the French are romantic and the Japanese, they would have been like copycats or something like that. So we're still stuck with these ideas like 150 years later because of nationalism. Nationalism is a very powerful force and it shapes how we see different nations in the world. So I think it's kind of a moot question about whether Americans can handle like too much Japanese-ness because I don't think there's anything inherently Japanese there's no inherent Japanese-ness that any one person can consume. Because what does it even mean to be Japanese? It's a question Japanese have debated for at least the last 150 years. And it's interestingly during this period, the 1980s and 1990s, that in Japan, this genre of publishing really booms. The genre is called Nihonjinron, which translates as like discussions of the Japanese, something like that. So it's basically a genre of like Japanese exceptionalism and Japanese exceptionalist literature on what makes Japan so different and special among the nations of the world. And in its most like caricatured form, it manifests as these claims that like, for instance, Japan can't buy more American rice because Japanese intestines are different and can't process American grown rice. There was another fight over much of this ends up in trade disputes because the American trade representatives are trying to get Japan to buy more American stuff. And so there was a big fight over skis, over, you know, skiing equipment, snow skis. And the Japanese argument was that Japanese snow is different and American skis don't work on Japanese snow. And these are the kinds of sort of absurd caricatures you get in this Nihonjinron literature that comes out of Japan in the 1980s and the 1990s. But it also can have a darker nationalistic tone too. And that's the kind of nationalism that feeds off of notions of cultural purity and the essential qualities of a nation. And there's this feedback loop across the Pacific because Americans are reading the Nihonjinron literature, which is the most sort of extreme thinking about Japanese nationalism. And they take that to be, this is what all Japanese believe, that they are a single God-divine race of 120 million hearts beating as one and so forth. So I don't know. Can Americans handle more Japanese-ness? I think they've actually absorbed a remarkable amount of it. If you think about the way in which these two societies that have seen each other historically is so fundamentally different, it's remarkable how much Japanese-ness we have in our lives that we kind of take for granted. That, as I say in the beginning of the book, it's simply become ordinary in our lives. Better question might be why Americans haven't consumed, you know, just as much stuff from other major Asian countries like India or China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that gets into the last question I have for you, because would you end the book by questioning how far we can take this comparison between Japan in the 1980s and China in our contemporary moment. And you have this wonderful line that I just like to read really quickly for listeners, where you write, you know, the analogy between Japan and China fails to hold up in terms of the two countries' comparative global cultural influence. China simply isn't cool, at least not in the way Japan has been for several decades now. So I want to know, in your view, why isn't China cool?
I don't want to say China's cool. I don't want to say China's not cool. You got to read it in the context of the chapter. So, you know, what I'm talking about in that moment is that Japan becomes a model in the 1970s and the 1980s. This is much of this is about, I write about in chapter one, is that on the one hand, we have this conversation about how Japan's a threat, how Japan's a challenge to American economic supremacy, that perhaps Japan might even become a potential political or military threat to the United States. But on the other hand, there's this quieter undercurrent of conversations about how Japan is kind of a model for the future. There's a Harvard sociologist, Ezra Vogel, writes a book in 1979 called Japan as Number One. And the argument there is that better than any other modern society, Japan has solved the modern world's problems when we think about anything from crime to drug use and so forth. Japan becomes a model again in 2008, 2009, except in a bad way this time. You know, during the 2008 recession and the aftermath of the 2008 recession, there's all these articles on how the United States has to avoid falling into the lost decade or the two lost decades that Japan experiences. This begins in, well, sort of 1989, but really is at its worst in the early and mid 1990s, when the Japanese economy, after the Japanese bubble bursts in the late 1980s, early 1990s, Japan's economy basically has almost two decades of flat growth. And in Japan, these are referred to as either the lost decade, or sometimes there's two lost decades. And yet, despite that, despite these conversations about how let's not become Japan, Japanese pop culture remains pretty cool after 2008. And even to this day, there's big national conventions that celebrate Japanese pop culture. There's anime. I was at Anime Expo in Los Angeles over the summer. There's 110,000 people there. So when we're thinking about the kind of Japanese model and Japanese analogs, inevitably China is going to be coming up, because for the last decade, at least, China has seemed to present the kind of economic threat, if not this time, including a very real military threat, that Japan presented in the 1980s. I don't know. Is China cool? Do young people in the United States want to watch Chinese cartoons or dress like young people in China? Not yet, at least. You know, the more interesting case, I think, and I talk about this at the end of the book too, is Korea and the so-called Korean wave, the Hallyu of pop culture that's washed over much of East Asia and Southeast Asia and even made its way to the United States in the last decades. College students, even here in rural North Louisiana, you know, they listen to K-pop music and they watch K-dramas on the internet. And Korean pop culture has become cool in ways that Japanese pop culture has been cool for a while, and China is not quite yet. And much of, on the Korean, for Korea at least, much of that is the product of an intentional campaign by the South Korean government to support the global spread of its pop culture industries, and it's banking on gaining some soft power from the popularity of its pop culture, even if nobody has any idea how you wield soft power once you get it. Japan's even tried to learn from Korea's example in that regard. It established like a ministry of cool a few years ago and dumped hundreds of millions of dollars into it. But, you know, at this point, 25 years later, into this pop culture boom, it might be too late to try to ride that wave. And, you know, to what end? How does a nation turn cultural popularity into hard power resources? I don't even know if that's a question China cares about answering right now. And it's never been an easy question to answer.
Well, Drew McAvitt, thank you so much for being on the program. It was a real pleasure to speak with you.
Matt, thanks so much for having me.
The book is Consuming Japan, Popular Culture and the Globalization of 1980s America through University of North Carolina Press. Go out and get a copy. Thank you for listening.